This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices, united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
Welcome back to another edition of the Extra Bases podcast on theyak.com. I'm Dustin McComas from orangebloods.com. And as many of you know, I am a big Major League Baseball draft nerd. It's one of my favorite times of the year. Been covering it from the Texas Pacific side for a long, long time. Been covering it for a little bit of a scouting angle as well. And I'm thrilled to say I'm joined by one of the most popular guys right now as it relates to the Major League Baseball draft, ESPN's Kylie McDaniel, who will be on the broadcast for the Major League Baseball draft. First, Kylie, thanks for joining us. I know you're a very, very busy man, but give us an idea of what the coverage is going to look like from ESPN's perspective. I mean, obviously, people are just dying to get any bit of sports right now, and ESPN, I'm thrilled that they've jumped on and to cover the Major League Baseball draft. So how are things going to look from y'all's end in presenting the draft?
So we're recording on Monday night, and I just got back to the – or I guess can get back to – got to the hotel for the first time. I flew into Bristol today, and we did like a sort of dress rehearsal. Our situation and MLB Network both did ours like sort of jointly, because I guess the broadcast itself will be somewhat jointly, because we have to, you know, come together around the commissioner saying the pick, so we're going to be tied together in that way at least. But I guess we'll do separate broadcasts, but yeah, through all the different I guess versions and discussions and behind the scenes stuff, we settled on broadcasting all five rounds. So I think the number they've been throwing around is as many as 10 hours of coverage throughout those five rounds, with, you know, obviously over those 2 days. So yeah, I guess we're starting 7 Eastern on Wednesday, and then 5 Eastern on Thursday, and we'll be with you the whole way. And it's going to be myself and Carl Ravitch in the studio, and then Kyle Peterson, Chris Burke, Eduardo Perez, Jeff Passan, and Jessica Mendoza, via Zoom or Blue Jeans or however it is we're doing it technologically, but joining us remotely. We got all kinds of fun stuff. We got TrackMan data, we got video packages and breakdowns, and, you know, doing all your spot shadows and your, you know, check out this mechanical thing. We got all the high speed video that Eric Longenhagen and I took at Fangraphs, and some that I took while I was at ESPN. Obviously not that much of a spring this spring for me to go get the high speed video of. But yeah, we got all those things working together, and today's rehearsal went well, and we're all pretty excited about it.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be a good one, and that's a lot of hours to fill for five rounds. That's 10 hours even for a normal draft would be a pretty good amount. So definitely looking forward to that. And for those listeners, a little background on Kylie: he started working with MLB clubs in 2005, worked for numerous clubs, including Yankees, Orioles, Pirates, Braves, and what you mentioned, Fangraphs. You were there for how many years, like 4 or 5 years at Fangraphs, doing starting their prospect coverage?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact years, but I think it was my first time I went there. I was basically, they didn't have any sort of full-time covered. I guess Mark Hewlett had done some prospect coverage, but they didn't have a full-time person doing it. And so then I came in and did it for, I want to say, 2 or 3 years before I went to the Braves. And then I came back and did, I want to say, another 2 years. So yeah, something like 4 or 5 total. And then obviously Eric filled in my absence, and then we did it together when I came back, and then I left to go to ESPN this past February.
And you mentioned Eric. He co-authored a book that you guys just published recently, Future Value, The Battle for Baseball's Soul and How Teams Will Find the Next Superstar. I just ordered it. I'm really excited to read it, because I've always wanted somebody to write that kind of book, because – people, you know, the average fan, or even the more, you know, diehard intelligent fan, you know, ask about scouting and thinks they kind of know scouting, but nobody's really written a book about what it's actually like to be in that grind. So what was kind of the genesis of that process? And, you know, what did going through that process kind of help teach you and allowing you to kind of make that bigger transition to ESPN and more of a media role, as opposed to being in the major league profession in the scouting capacity?
So the initial pitch actually came from the publishers at Triumph, and the pitch was Moneyball, the book, came out 15 years ago, and the worry from scouts at that time was, oh, we're going to get replaced by analysts. And the opposite actually happened, because especially the lower minors in amateur baseball, it turns out that, you know, the analysts dig into it and scouting reports were the most predictive numbers because the actual stats, you know, the on-base percentage, the things that they were citing, if no one's paying attention to it, then those things are important and they're low-hanging fruit. But when everyone pays attention to it, you need to then find the next thing. And the next thing didn't exist yet statistically. It was still surface stats. And so the scouting report was the next thing. If you had better scouts and more reports and more history and all these sorts of things, you could predict those players better. And some of the advanced stats were, you know, useful at the upper levels of the minors, but there's also fewer scouts there because it's so close to the big leagues. You don't need as much, you know, eyeball scouting at that level. But then what happened with the advent of TrackMan, Hawkeye, you know, all the various different radar and optical-based technologies that are at the ballparks. StatCast, I guess, is the way that a lot of fans have interacted with it. And you also have all of these different bat sensors, the Rapsodo. Like, you got all kinds of stuff. And it turns out that a lot of the things that the scouts were seeing that made them valuable back in the day, so, you know, post-Moneyball, teams were actually expanding the amount of scouts they had to get more data. Now this data can measure a bunch of the stuff that you could only measure using scouts. And so some teams look at that and say, we can get this data for cheaper than a person costs. There's no benefits. There's no travel. And we think we can make close to, if not better, decisions using this data. So let's get rid of some scouts, hire some analysts, buy some data, and we're going to make better decisions and it's going to cost us less money. A bunch of teams are doing that. The Astros are sort of like leading the charge. And so now scouts are literally getting replaced by analysts. The thing they were scared of is now happening. And so the publisher was basically saying, you know, we've been following what Eric and you have been writing, and you seem to be, you know, sort of well-versed in this general area, both understanding the metrics, like we're the only place that's publishing TrackMan data from the minors and amateur baseball on the site, and also writing about, you know, the JUCO data wars. If you want to know more about that, just Google it. I'm sure we're the only article about that on the internet. You know, do you want to write about it? And so we basically broke it down into three parts, which is how scouting works. So there's one chapter on the draft and two on international science, so much more complex and so much harder to explain to a casual fan. And it's basically rules and strategy and all kinds of things like that mixed in with a bunch of stories. And the story people keep telling me that have read the book that stands out the most, this is one about how the Marlins discovered JT Realmuto. If you try to imagine like a movie about scouting and you discover a player in the middle of nowhere you weren't prepared for, it's basically that sort of genre of story. But it's just about an actual all-star. So it's pretty exciting. So that's the first part of it. The second part of it is how to scout. It's like almost 100 pages over three chapters telling you this is what scouts look for. This is how you grade a hit tool. This is, you know, these are examples of, you know, benchmarks to kind of, you know, keep you on your guide rails and kind of know what you're looking at. And then the third part is basically like a brief history and then a lot of what's going on right now in stats and saying, hey, this is the number that Houston is using to justify not having a scout because they have this data. And this number, you know, this is how they grade a fastball by not actually watching it, just by using the data. And then they'll supplement it with some video scouting, things like that. And then the last chapter is basically us passing some judgment and saying, here's where we think sort of the correct answers are. And as you may guess, it's somewhere in the middle between those two things. So that's sort of like the way we decided to break it down. And I thought we were, it ended up working out well that I think the publisher pushed us in the direction initially that I think both was compelling to like a casual or a diehard fan and like uniquely played into Eric and I's strengths of sort of having the behind the scenes somewhat in the weeds stuff, but then making it, you know, tell a bigger story. And the sort of narrative elements of the book actually ended up accidentally being around the scouts that were telling the stories because they've all been in the game for 20, 30, 40 years. They all know each other. And it turned out their stories are referencing back to each other. And a lot of them used to work with each other and then they went head to head with each other. And so those are sort of like the characters you kind of get to know throughout the story.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that. Said, I've been wanting a book like this for somebody to kind of explain that perspective and that process, because I don't think the average fan understands, like, you know, you don't just show up to a game with a radar gun on occasion. There is a very, very intricate, long process that goes into it. And these guys are spending so many hours away from home. And all these things. And I'm really looking forward to that. And you mentioned TrackMan. You know, you had I saw on ESPN recently, you had that story on, I think it was Nick Bitsko, the right-handed pitcher, the prep guy, that reclassified to the 2020 class, which I don't know if I've ever seen that for baseball. It happens all the time in basketball with these big-time high school guys that kind of just fluctuate between classes and pick which one they want to get into. But he reclassified into the 2020 class, and he hasn't really thrown, like, at all. I think he threw, like, what, three innings at an East Cobb showcased or something like that. So scouts really haven't seen him, but you were able to get your hands on some TrackMan data and some things like that. Now this guy is being mocked in first rounds. I saw you got him number 15 on your latest list. How has TrackMan changed scouting and changed the draft? I mean, I'm sure that's a word that you guys are going to mention a lot when the Wednesday coverage covers, because I see a guy like that in a story like that. And yeah, the velocity would pop and, you know, people would pay attention to it. But I don't know if that guy rockets up the list without TrackMan, because he just hadn't thrown. But here you've got the data, you've got the spin, you get the efficiency and all these things. And he's probably going to be a first round pick.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, because as I was, you know, over the last 15 years, sort of going from not understanding scouting at all to slowly getting it and kind of picking out the spots where I thought there was some inconsistency, where like, oh, scouts tend to do this, but if you had a certain amount of data, you know, from the sort of Astros point of view, you'd have a little better idea. And one of the things that always bothered me was whenever I would ask a scout, hey, this guy went in the first round, everybody had him in the first round, and then he flamed out and it wasn't because he was injured. What happened? And invariably, the explanation is usually, for a hitter, this guy couldn't hit, which doesn't explain anything. It tells me what already happened. And then for a pitcher, it's if he didn't get hurt and his stuff didn't go down in a meaningful way. Like, he basically just stayed healthy and did the same thing and just didn't make it. It was like, oh, his fastball didn't play, because, and then they'd give you a reason. Like, it was, you know, not enough deception, or it was too flat, or they could sit on his breaking ball because it didn't improve. Or it'd be something where it's like, that probably had something to do with it. That doesn't feel like enough to explain how a guy went from consensus first round pick to can't make the big leagues. Because, you know, if a guy gets hurt, if the velo goes down five ticks, that's all you need. That explains it. And so it turns out now the TrackMan data can, in most cases, in the vast majority of cases, when a guy throws 98, but he doesn't get a lot of swing distances, and another guy throws 92, but he does, and it's not a super obvious like Greg Maddux versus, you know, Jason Nabergall or something like that. They're both like pretty good pitchers that were, you know, similarly valued. It's just one throws hard and one doesn't, but they're similar players. TrackMan can actually, the data within can tell you why it didn't work. And usually it is the shape of the fastball is not conducive to whiffs. And so what a lot of times will happen, especially with younger pitchers that don't necessarily have the mental game down, is they throw 98, they're used to throwing it by everybody. Once people can hit 98, if the shape of your fastball, and by that I mean the tilt, spin direction, if it's two seam, four seam, does it sink, does it rise, does it have run, all those sorts of things. I can really get in the weeds if you want to, but essentially there is one style of fastball that almost always gets more whiffs, and there's one that almost always gets, you know, weaker contact. And so if you throw 98 in high school, no one can touch it, you get tons of swings and misses. You don't have to learn how to pitch because you're just throwing it past everybody. You get to double A, if you're throwing more of a two seam or pitch to contact type pitch, all of a sudden people are hitting it, and they might be hitting it hard if you're not putting it in good locations because you didn't know how to pitch. And if that guy doesn't make the big leagues or just becomes like a triple A reliever, up down guy, that kind of thing, this guy would say like, oh, his fastball is a little more hittable than we thought. And it's like, well, that's not enough, dude. Like, you need to give me more than this sort of post fact thing. And so that is where this stuff is super useful, is it can tell you, especially in the case of Bitsko, normally back in the day, you know, 30, 40 years, when teams would look at him, they would say, we have three innings, but for us to know and have some confidence that this curveball will actually play at a higher level, we can't see him against pro hitters yet, but we can see him against the best high school hitters. And so we need 15 innings of him against really good high school hitters, or 60 innings against not very good high school hitters, to be able to watch it enough and observe how the hitters react to it and see how it plays and what his numbers are and all these different things you get from a bulk of performance to understand how the pitch plays. Now we can look at the characteristics and say, oh, provided he has passable command, passable sequencing, all these sort of things, we assume that they're there at some level, which, you know, those are teachable if they're not present. We know how this will play. And sometimes teams that lean on the analytics will think they know too much and just look for pitchers with like one or two characteristics they like and assume that they can teach them everything else, or that everything else can be sort of fixed or smoothed over. That is what a lot of teams do in the draft now, is you can sort of pin them to a certain type of player because they have a certain development philosophy. Usually it's for a good reason, because they have a track record of fixing that type of player. But in Bitsko's case, this data in the article that I wrote, it compared his fastball to There are 10 guys that compared to most, and six of them were like well above average big league pitchers with like plus fastballs. It has 99% spin efficiency, which means it gets the maximum amount of sort of lift, which is what gets you the swings and misses on a fastball. His slider compared to Luis Castillo and his curveball compared to Chris Paddock. And by compared to, I mean it is within a fraction of an inch in every direction, within a couple percentage points of the spin rate. The spin direction is almost the same. It's like almost every element of the pitch, if you just take it from out of his hand to the plate. Obviously, he doesn't have as good command, isn't as, you know, physically mature, like all these sorts of things that Chris Paddock has. That's great. Chris Paddock wasn't this good until a couple years before he got there. This guy is that good at 17, and he actually improved it pretty dramatically in the last month without any pro instruction. It was like Driveline helping him remotely while he was in a warehouse in Pennsylvania, and they just happen to have a Rapsodo unit there. Like, it is very sort of bare bones, and so a lot of teams are looking at this and saying, well, this data tells us, similar to what we would know after watching him for 50 innings, and him adjusting this quickly and having this sort of attitude and ability to adjust, this tells us, you know, something about his makeup that might take us a year or two in pro ball to learn. You could argue that with all of this data, if you have a comparable player with a longer track record but nothing in quarantine and no data, we know more about Nick Bitsko and have more certainty about him than we do about a comparable player that traditionally has a longer track record. And that's the part that the data plays.
Yeah, and would you ever have imagined like 10 or 15 years ago that high school pitchers would be tweeting out videos of their like bullpen session with like data and spin efficiency and velocity and all this stuff? Like, I continue to be amazed that now we're seeing high school kids, you know, tweeting out stuff like this. Like, hey, you know, obviously the circumstances right now are that they're doing this because they're not playing games. So. But even still, I mean, these guys are taking bullpen sessions. They're getting their data in some cases, and they're sharing these things. And it's like, I just could never have imagined like 10 or 15 years ago, a high school pitcher would be like, hey, I'm throwing 97, but my spin efficiency is 99%.
Yeah. And the crazy part is, I don't think many of these kids actually understand the sort of like physics or the reasoning why you want 100% spin efficiency on a fastball, and then you also want 0% or close to it spin efficiency on a slider, and then you need like, you know, this amount of spin deflection on your curveball. Like, understanding the physics at a deep level, even I've like been looking into this for years and still don't completely understand it. When people start throwing out the Magnus effect, my eyes kind of glaze over, and I'm like, let's go back to like the sort of words that are given to you in a TrackMan or a Rapsodo readout, because those are a little more what I understand, rather than explaining why this is the same thing as the, you know, the Coriolis effect, or like why wings give a airplane lift, because that's essentially the sort of stuff we're talking
about.
Yeah,
I don't have a doctorate degree, all right? Like, give me the basics.
Yeah, like I know enough to be dangerous. But yeah. But the crazy thing is, the kids now know, because it's become widespread enough through like, you know, StatCast games with Mike Petriello on it on ESPN, and Driveline and other places like it, you know, tweeting stuff out, and then people like me writing about Bitsko, they now know like, oh, I want to get 100% spin efficiency. I'll just go and throw pitches until I screw with it, and that number's the right way. It's almost like turned into a video game where you tell them what they need to achieve, and they get to use like their best quality, which is playing the sport really well and being athletic and figuring stuff out, and you sort of mix it with sort of a gamification of keeping them engaged and giving them something to shoot for. And so it's turned into this thing where the kids are doing almost what a physics major would, or physics professional would tell them how to do this stuff. And they just have sort of figured it out on Twitter. And then they just, you know, because this Rapsodo unit is like ideal for bullpens and it costs a couple $1,000s, like any good teacher or guy that teaches pitching can afford one of these things if he's getting hundreds of dollars per lesson with these kids. And so like anybody that is of, you know, any sort of means or any sort of quality that can get sort of like free instruction because they're a Division I athlete. And so, you know, somebody wants them at their facility to sort of promote themselves. It's like, it's not super easy, but it is not incredibly difficult to get in front of these machines, know what to do, and then be able to work into the direction to get better. And 10, 12 years ago, I don't think any college in America understood this, and very few teams understood it. And now it's just like random kids in warehouses in the middle of nowhere understand the physics of how to throw a pitch and how to make it better, and they can compare themselves to big leaguers in real time. And that is insane. Like, it's like a real democratization in it, like an exciting way for the kid that couldn't afford to go to travel baseball. How do I get better and make the big leagues? It's like, it is as easy now as it has ever been. There are still things that need to be fixed, but it's continuing to get easier.
Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, the analytics departments that all these college programs have, and you know, this, you know, so much of the draft, as you know better than I, is risk assessment as much as it is evaluating talent and all these things. And you know, college guys have been kind of labeled as less risky because you could go get more of that data. You could, you know, not just the stats, but you know, the TrackMan stuff and everything like that. But now these high school kids might be kind of cut into that a little bit, because it's a different game, I would think, if you've got a high school guy, because you know, you've take a Jared Kelly, for example, he's playing competition at the high school level, the non-travel ball circuit, his high school circuit, that can't touch him. I mean, they're not good enough to. But so that guy might be a little tougher to evaluate with more risk opposed to that college player, because you can kind of look at more data and the competition and all those sorts of things. But you know, do you think these high school kids getting more access to this and having more people around them kind of teaching them about this can maybe cut into that risk associated with them as draft picks a little bit more?
Yeah, and I think there's also been a little bit of a shift now, that because some of these heavy model teams that are basically just looking for one or two traits, because you know, the funny, I'll take a short sidebar here. It's become funny to me that scout-leaning teams, in terms of their draft philosophy, used to take huge tools, and then the teams that lean more toward analysts would take safe college guys that were, you know, lower upside but high probability. And now, because we can quantify the upside of a player, it's not somebody writing a 70 on a scouting report, it's somebody seeing 112 on an exit velo. Now the progressive teams are taking all of the tools guys, because they're saying like, well, this guy has these two traits, we can fix the rest. And the scouts are now saying, well, wait, what about this gamer with a bunch of 50 tools? He's actually better than the tools that I told you he had. And look, there's some numbers there. Like, they end up now arguing the opposite end of the spectrum, because once you can quantify the thing that wasn't able to be quantified, it now becomes sort of a progressive point of view. I forgot what your question was, but I've just always found that very interesting.
Yeah, I was just saying, you know, you mentioned the aspect of the college player, you know, kind of those safer, lower risk guys. I mean, so much of the draft is risk assessment. Do you think those high school guys, by getting more of this information, or more of these guys being around people that provide them a rap soda and teach them about this stuff, can you think that'll kind of change how they're viewed as is maybe a little bit less risky, because you can get more access to that data?
Yeah. So the other part that goes, the reason I took the little detour there, was because the teams that look at players as, do you have the two or three qualities we like? And then if you have other stuff, great, we'll move you up more, but we only really want these three qualities. A lot of that is, if you are 21 and you have a track record in college, that's great. If it's a really good track record, cool. Those three qualities are still there and you have some other stuff, but now everybody, because of your track record, if you're Spencer Torkelson or whoever it is, everyone else also values you similarly. So you having those three qualities isn't like unique to our evaluation of you. The guy that, you know, we will take a chance on probably is good at those three things and then is not good at some other things. And so we value him more highly than other teams do. When you look at players like that, an 18-year-old has, if you think of like concrete, it is not as set. So they may be a slightly better athlete with a little more upside, and they haven't been taught as many negative things and created bad habits. And so they're sort of, if you go through this sort of idea of like the, you know, the three skills that they're looking for, an 18-year-old with a limited track record, but you are confident that the metrics are correct in terms of, you know, exit velos and, you know, strength or twitchiness or, you know, whatever your qualities are that you like, that guy, or a guy with a middling track record or slowly improve, that's a 21-year-old and say in the Big Ten, a lot of those teams would prefer the high school player. And because that high school player may not be valued as highly by other teams, you then get him much cheaper. Whereas the college guy with numbers, everyone's got a similar viewpoint of that guy. Everybody's seen him for 3 years. Whereas this, you know, potentially undervalued high school guy can be seen as like a better asset. And I think you see that with teams like, you know, Houston, Milwaukee, that sort of, or even Baltimore, that are from that sort of tree of thinking. You'll go look at the guys they give $500,000 to in like third, fourth, fifth round, or overpays later. They are not guys that are high on the rankings. It's the guys that like not necessarily went to all the showcases and are very well known and play in like, you know, Florida and Texas and California and play against very high end competition. It's the guys that have the qualities they like. And so I think some of those teams, you know, specifically the most progressive teams, almost prefer the 18-year-old because it is a blanker slate to work with potentially more upside.
I know you talk to way more scouts and agents and everybody else than I do, but the few I've talked to about the draft, just the only consistent thing I've been told is that nobody really knows how this thing is going to play out. And I guess that's true to a much lesser extent with any normal draft. I mean, there's only so much you can predict, you know, after the first, you know, half of the first round or whatever, but just seems like everybody I talk to is like shoulder shrugs. Like we don't really know how this is going to play out. So I think I see people kind of educated guessing that it might be a more college heavy draft just from the risk assessment standpoint, because, you know, with these high school guys, you weren't really able to see them as much. It's a little harder to kind of, you know, stick your neck out there for some of those guys. But what have you heard about how you think this might play out in terms of, you know, would there be a lot of teams kind of seeking those, you know, under slot deals and taking more of those college players that they can maybe save money with and are less risky? Or do you think it'll be, you know, kind of more traditional in that you'll see a lot of those prep talents go where their talent suggests that they should, even in the situation where they might not have been scouted as much as the traditional draft of the high school players?
Yeah, there's a lot of theories floating around, but I don't think the teams really – I mean, obviously, each team has a pretty good idea of what they want to do, not even what they will do, obviously. But, you know, an idea of what they're – like, I talked to one guy with the team today, and he was like, yeah, like, we don't know who we're taking. They're in the back half of the first round. But we have, you know, contingencies A through F for, you know, off of our main plan. But, like, we don't know which one it's going to be. So, that, you know, that's where about the teams are probably, like, a little less certainty at this point than there is any other year. But I think the general consensus is those 5 to 10 high school guys that are premium tools, long track record, they play in warm weather climates, especially Florida and Arizona, because for spring training, they get seen a ton early because all the executives are in town. Those guys are all going to go where they're going to go in normal year. So they're fine. Almost everyone else behind them on the high school side is at huge risk. There are some teams, and I guess I've written this, it hasn't gone up yet. There are multiple teams, like maybe double-digit teams, that only have 20 or 30 high school players even on their board. Wow. And there are guys that will possibly go in the top 30 picks that some teams don't have on their board because they just didn't see them this spring, and they're not going to give $3 million to some guy they didn't see this spring. Which, you know, I can see how they land on that decision, but it also means there's going to be a bunch of teams that just don't take a high school player. And in that event, you're just going to see a bunch of college players. And part of the reason they're doing that is because if you're in the second round and you're looking at, you know, Drew Romo, a catcher out of Texas that's committed to LSU, that's seen as like, you know, maybe 50-50 that he'll sign. Like if he gets past about pick 60-65, he's going to go to school, roughly speaking. And eventually, like, the money to be commensurate with pick 50 or 60 will eventually run out, maybe early in the third round. So there is a point where these guys will just, there's no chance the money's left. Whereas in a normal draft, it's like, somebody might be able to come up with the right amount of money in the 13th round, if, you know, a couple guys were below slot that we weren't aware of. But all that to say, once you get to that area, you can take a college guy like Daniel Cabrera from LSU that you've been watching since he was a sophomore in high school. You got 3 years at LSU. You know exactly what he is. You got to see him a lot this spring. And Drew Romo's in Texas. You got to see him a little bit this spring, but then like Caden Wallace in Arkansas, pretty much nobody saw him this spring. And I was told that he is basically heard from his representation that, like, I have him ranked, I think, in the late 50s. Everybody thinks his talent fits in the late 50s. His price is basically based on going in the late 50s. And teams are like, we can take Daniel Cabrera or somebody like that, that we have all kinds of history with, that we got to see this year. Caden Wallace, we didn't see this year. Why would we give that guy that much money? Because we haven't seen him play in 8 months. It's not his fault. Like, if we would have had one more month, we would have seen him and he would have gone there. But, like, that extra month was the difference between Austin Hendrick and Nick Bitsko playing in Pennsylvania and Caden Wallace getting seen in Arkansas, and then Zach Veen in Florida and Carson Tucker in Arizona getting seen a ton and being notably better than they were before. And so they basically, whatever jump they would have gotten from this spring, they already got the whole boost because they were seen enough in that, like, you know, month where players could be seen. And they also started earlier than everybody else. So that's, I think, the big overarching trend is fewer high school players. And because there's not that many rounds, you can't really do like a version of what the Braves did last year, which is just go under slot for basically all of their picks through the first 10 rounds. And then you got a bunch of money left over and you see which high school players are left and then just keep spending on them until you run out of money. And I think they signed, I want to say like 6 guys over $300,000 as high school players after the 10th round last year. And they didn't know who they were going to get. Like, they had some ideas of who was going to get there. And a lot of teams will do that where they're just like, all right, we don't feel super strongly about anybody at, you know, the second round pick, so we'll just take the cheapest guy of the five or six that we like here. But in this draft, you're only taking, you know, five, anywhere from four to seven guys, depending on how many picks you have. And so you can't really do like the kick the can down the road. We'll just take the cheapest guy that we like here, because eventually you're going to end up with, you know, $1.8 million left on your last pick. And if the best guy you like there is worth $1.1 million, you just didn't spend $700,000 and you're going to feel stupid and you don't have a way to spend it. And so I think a lot of teams are just going to play it straight, try to trim a little bit on their college picks, have one big high school pick that they've sort of telegraphed rounds in advance. And then once they pay him, then they'll just kind of figure out, do we need to like basically sign seniors the last two picks? Did we really blow it out? Or did we play it like pretty straight and just move a little money around and we'll play straight in rounds four through five? I think that's basically what's going to happen. It's going to be a lot of playing it straight. It's going to be a lot of college. It's going to be not very much high school. And there's not going to be a lot of like drastically over slot, drastically under slot. There's not going to be a multiple guys signing for $2 million in the fifth round. Like just stuff like that's not going to happen. There's too much going on. And also the communication is too difficult to really pull that kind of thing off.
Yeah. It seems like the shortened draft is going to cut into those financial games that teams tend to play. I mean, you brought up the Braves. That's the first example I thought of in terms of what they're doing with their high school guys after those first 10 rounds. And to me, kind of a wild card in this is, you know, Major League Baseball owners. I don't know how much of an impact, you know, a couple of those or even, you know, maybe half the teams, or I don't know what kind of feedback those teams get from ownership in terms of, hey, if you could you try to save us some money in this situation? Which to me is just weird because it's the cheapest way, I think, that teams acquire talent. I mean, if you nail one of these guys in the draft, you're getting well below market value for a long, long time in terms of roster control and things like that. But I just have in my head a vision of like the fifth round as being like all college guys, because teams are like, well, we can just leverage these guys and save money. And, you know, maybe a couple of teams have had their owners tell them, hey, try to cut some money when you can. Do you think that at all is a factor, just the Major League Baseball where it is right now, at these owners that are, you know, a lot of these guys are crime poor because they don't have that usual cash flow coming in with the games?
Yeah, I am sympathetic to the idea that while they are very rich, they don't have a cash flow right now, and some of them are sensitive to these things, and they want to be financially prudent going forward. But with that said, the idea that the Nationals owner worth $3 billion who just won a World Series and got tens of millions of like surprise dollars show up because of the World Series needs to cut the minor league stipend of his of his players by $100 a week, because that's the exact right amount of money. And then once he was shamed, he decided not to. Obviously,
he didn't even last 24 hours. He didn't even make a day.
Obviously, he had no idea where the line was and just assumed he would look fine. And then he didn't look fine. And so he's like, okay, the bad PR is not worth that amount of money that I'm saving. And then the A's owner basically said like, oh, I don't have enough money to pay my minor leaguers. And then literally every other team said, oh, well, we do. And then he was like, oh, just kidding, I do. And it's like, okay, they don't actually know where the line is. They're just trying to cut money in any place they can just to, you know, possibly save something. But like, they're not actually in trouble or nobody would be playing their minor leaguers. And they are. And when, you know, the Nationals say they have to cut it, and then like the Twins and the Royals say, we're not even going to release the players that absolutely should be a release that we planned on releasing, that we were going to release a week later. We're going to keep them anyway, because that's the right thing to do. It's like, okay, none of you have to do any of this. You're just choosing to. And so all the buzz in the industry, which is real, that some teams are going to intentionally not spend their entire draft allotment, and that some teams are just going to offer 70% of slot for their first three picks, because if the guy doesn't sign, then they get a comp pick. I don't doubt that some teams are talking about doing that, or that some teams will do it. But the idea that like the scouting director is told to do this, because if you say you do this with your first three picks and you don't sign any of the three picks, and so you get to save $300,000 of those deferred bonuses over the next year, those $300,000 might save someone's job. And then the scouting director is emboldened because he thinks he's a hero. He's either going to get a great discount for his owner and get a pat on the back by getting the players at a lower bonus, or he's going to save the job of one of his area scouts, is completely insane, because it doesn't have to be that. And he's squeezing the college player or the high school player, but probably a college player in the situation, even more than he's already getting squeezed by the bonus slots not going up and by the deferrals, which is like an interest-free loan to a billionaire from a kid that doesn't have very much money. So it's already sort of insane that we've accepted the idea that like municipalities should just give stadiums to these owners And then as they make money, they don't share. Everyone sticks to their contracts. And then once they're not making money, all of a sudden everybody has to give their money back. And then once they get profitable again, nobody else gets the money again. Like, if Microsoft was run this way, they would be like broken up by the government and people would get thrown in jail. And it is insane that just because these baseball teams are like part of the community and they're like, you know, different in a way, they're part of the community and they give to the community and they get back even more than they give, that we think some of these things are okay. But I explained it this way on one of the radio shows I went on. If Microsoft was losing money as a result of the pandemic and wanted to raise money by cutting the pay of their staff, and then the agreement was, once we start making money again, you guys just go back to making what's on your contract and we don't even pay you back the money we docked you. Like, that is absolutely bonkers. But because it's the sport, we're just like, oh yeah, the billionaire that owns the team that I like, they're losing money. So, like, you know, do what you need to do. And the stuff that Artie Moreno did is like, oh boy. The owner of the Angels, like, they just like furloughed all their scouts the week before the draft. It would have cost them, I think it was less than $100,000 to just keep his scouts through the draft. And I can tell you from being in a draft room, there are all kinds of situations throughout the draft where the people in the room, which doesn't usually involve that many area scouts, and sometimes it involves none of them, where you want to talk about a player and you need to check on something with the area scout who knows the player. It's something, you know, maybe you want to make sure it's right. Maybe you want to get some assurances. You want to like double check a background fact. They've furloughed their area scouts. They can't ask them these questions anymore. It's totally bonkers that this is okay. And that we're people are just treating Artie Moreno, which they're not, but like some people are treating Artie Moreno like, oh, well, you know, his company's losing money. And so he has to, you know, make the tough choices. And for some reason, the Nationals owner and the A's owner were shamed as doing the right thing. And Artie Moreno just gets to, you know, do this terrible thing. And it eventually people will kind of forget about it because it happened a little while.
Yeah, we could spend hours talking about it. To me, the biggest, one of the strangest things about this entire negotiation process is that it seems like a majority of the average fans sympathize with the owners. And it just blows my mind.
They root for the team, and the owner is the only part of the team that doesn't change. I can see how you land there. There's no critical thought behind it. I mean, when I was a kid, I felt that way too.
Yeah, it's, you know, I guess people turn on the TV and they see the guys playing and they associate these guys like, oh, they're making all this money to play a game. But nobody really.
Yeah, you also know how much the player makes.
Exactly.
And you don't know
it's
how
always
much the owner
what's,
makes.
What's the first thing that comes up when Chris Sale needs Tommy John surgery? Oh, the Red Sox shouldn't have signed him to that long-term deal worth all of this money and this and that and all these sorts of things. It's never broadcast like on TV. All the, there's not a winter meetings for owners' net worth, like, or the Forbes list or whatever. Like,
no, yeah, like if it was Artie, guys. If it was Artie Moreno cleared $400 million in profit. When he's cutting his scouts like the week before the draft, it's like, oh, let's throw those figures on SportsCenter and see how he feels about that. But he doesn't want you to know that. And that's part of the reason they don't put out the financials, is they don't want you knowing how much money they were making when things were going well. And they don't want you to know how much they're losing right now, because they're just going to lie about both of them because that serves their purposes.
Yeah, and be very good at leaking things to the media to make themselves look better. Like the whole revenue sharing thing, like, just it flew over the heads of so many MLB fans. Like, what's the big deal? It's like, you don't understand that they didn't want to share any of these revenues with anybody for a long time when they're making tons of money. And now that they're not making money, they wanted to share their revenues. Like, that's not how it works when you don't have the salary cap. So it just blows my mind to see so many fans are like, oh, David Price, like, oh, he's got $217 million contract. Of course he can afford to pay the minor leaguers. It's like, well, what about the ownership group that's worth billions of dollars instead of the player that's worth millions of dollars? I don't know. We could go on for a long
time. Yeah, I'd like to think that people now can see, like, oh, the team is worth billions. The owner is worth billions. These players are worth tens of millions in the big cases. Some of them are even worth less than a million. And so when Sean Doolittle, who's been making whatever it is, $8 or $10 million for a little while, but not forever, and never making $20 million, and sometimes making the minimum, he's paying the minor leaguers to make up for what the billionaire decides he doesn't want to pay for the company that just made all kinds of money very recently in a very public way. It's like, oh, any moron can read the headline and do the math and be like, oh, Sean Doolittle is doing a thing he doesn't have to do that, like, he can afford. It might even be a stretch, but it probably isn't. And so the owner that's worth like 100 times more than he is, maybe more than that, cannot do it. Now that seems kind of fishy. It's like Sean Doolittle doing that sort of, you know, very effectively shame the owner, because it's like, no matter how you do this math, the owner could do this much more easily than Sean Doolittle is. And so that is why I think it is easier in these specific times for someone to be able to do the math of like, oh, I don't know exactly how much money all these people have, but that guy has way more than this other guy. And so when the guy with less money is being generous, I know that the rich guy should be generous too.
Yeah, it's. I just hope we get a baseball season.
Let's talk about the Texas guys.
Yeah,
we got a bunch of dudes in this
draft. Well, yeah, let's get to the stuff that's going to make the Texas fans want to go grab a beer or bourbon or whatever, because they have a very, very good signing class, but I have a very good feeling that the top of it it's probably going to get decimated, which, I mean,
that's it's almost too good. I mean, that unfortunately that happens with baseball. You don't want to get the best signing class before the draft. You want to have like a mid-tier one, cause you might keep those guys.
Yeah. Unless you're Vanderbilt, you want to get those guys that are kind of in that tier just below that kind of elite tier of high school players. But I'm looking at your latest top 150 list. And I think the first Texas signing you've got on the list is Jared Kelly. I think everybody knows that this guy's going to go pro.
95%. I mean, it would have to be like one of those, he agrees to a deal and then he fails the physical to a point where they can't even agree to a deal, which I'll call 5%, with something that isn't the teams aren't aware of right now. That happens a couple times a draft. It's still pretty rare. Like maybe one time out of the top two rounds. Obviously this year, there's not quite as much medical information shared because of the whole, you know, can you get an MRI in a pandemic, all that kind of thing. So the only reason that one's not 100% is just because of, there's a chance that there's a medical thing that pops up to where he can't get a deal done, like the Carter Stewart situation. But obviously that is very unlikely.
Yeah, I wonder if there's more of those situations, just because, as you said, getting access to medical information, these guys getting it and sending it on might be a little more difficult given the circumstances. But you've got him at number 26, another Texas guy just behind him, Tanner Witt, who – catching some helium right now. He's a guy that I think we've mentioned teams that, you know, pay attention to their models and things like that. He's young for a high school senior, which teams like. They don't like the older guys for high school seniors. And also you mentioned too, the curveball and the spin rate, like the 3000 RPM, which is, I mean, for people that aren't very familiar with that, that is a monstrous number. I mean, for anybody, for the best breaking balls in Major League Baseball, and he's obviously got a professional background as well, with his dad being in the professional ranks in the teaching capacity and things like that. So, it sounds to me like he's kind of a toss-up type situation. I don't know if you're hearing the same, but he seems like a guy that's really shot up these lists. Where I think a couple months ago you wouldn't have expected Tanner Witt to be, you know, in the first round discussion.
Yeah, I think it's probably 50-50. It's been relayed to me. That makes it sound like it's for sure. It has been indicated to me that Witt has interest as high as the teens. I think he will, on talent, if we're just taking everybody on talent, not looking at signability, would go somewhere in the 25 to 40 area. It sounds like he's signable through about pick 35 or so. One person described it as, if he doesn't go on the first day, he's probably not going to sign. But that also means, you know, if somebody can get 30th overall slot at the 50th pick, then that's probably signable. It's just, you know, broadly speaking. So he's basically signable right where I think he goes. But as a high school pitcher with a limited background of like sort of pitching at the highest levels, there's a good spot of like 10 to 12 picks where it makes total sense for him to sign for close to slot. And for him to be the top guy with a short track record on all of those boards is almost impossible. So it's down to five or six teams where they're in a position to take him. They can afford him for close to slot. Is he going to be the top guy on their board when they get to him? I don't know. That's why it's basically 50-50.
Carson Tucker, you mentioned the guys in, you know, those warm weather states. I was telling Texas fans, hey, the unfortunate thing for Carson Tucker for y'all is he's probably the most scouted high school infielder in the country, given his proximity in Arizona to all those spring training facilities and things like that. It sounded like he started to show more power as well. I think that he's going to be gone. You've got him at number 33 on the list. Do you think he's like older brother and kind of sneaks into the back end of the first round?
That's the buzz right now. He also has a little interest in the late teens, early 20s. I think his sort of reasonable landing spots are probably in that 25 to 40 area. And the indications are similar to Kelly, that if he goes in that area as expected, that he will sign. And so I would say, short of a, you know, medical snafu or whatnot, he'll go day one or in the first five picks of day two and sign there. So yeah, I would say him and Kelly are both at that, whatever you want to call it, 95%. And then Witt will say is at 50-50.
Jared Jones at 51, I would venture to say he's got to be in that, probably that 95 percentile range. I think when he committed, yep, which was a long time ago, I mean, these college programs commit these kids so early. It's crazy to me that these guys, that we got to recruit these guys 3 and 4 years in advance and just hope their projections are right. No, by the way, they're they're cramming their evaluations basically into a couple months in the summer. But you got him at number 51. I think the control and command were questions when he committed, and Texas kind of thought, hey, we might be able to get this guy on campus. But it sounds like he's shown enough. I mean, with that arm strength, you don't really see many guys with that kind of arm strength not sign out of high school. Would you say 95% for him as well, probably?
Yeah, maybe a little bit lower. It sounds like he is pretty likely to go in the, call it 40 to 60 overall range. It sounds like he's signable there. But if it slips down to, you know, 70, 80 overall, like it's a high school righty with iffy command, like there's a chance that he just sort of slides a little bit to the bottom of that range. And then maybe like money kind of runs out. I mean, let's call it like 85%. Like it's maybe a little bit lower, but I would still like definitely bet on it. It's way more likely than, I don't want to say, you know, betting. Like, I mean, it would be something if I could bet on this. I'd probably make money. But unfortunately,
yeah, how come are there not like any Bovada or Five Dimes odds on like the draft? Like that, you know,
I have joked that my greatest money making venture will not be betting on the draft. It will be setting the odds for the draft, because after I set the odds, I, you know, selfishly think I would set pretty good odds, that they would then make so much money off of me setting the odds that I then become the most valuable part of the operation. is that, you know, I put out a mock draft, all of a sudden the market would move a little bit, you know, in some direction, and then we could move the odds before that. Like, it would make perfect sense. It's just, you know, this ESPN broadcast gets enough viewers, then, you know, maybe this business can make some sense. I know we have relationships with, I believe, Caesar's Palace as a company, so... I mean, there's a natural transition if the interest is there. I guess people tweet it, ESPN, tell them you'd like to bet on the draft.
Yeah, I mean, I trust me, I know plenty of degenerates that would absolutely bet on the Major League Baseball draft. Just create like an alias, you know, like something like the Greek or something like that on the internet, and build a website and kind of start your odds and things like that, and you'll be getting rich in no time, because there'd definitely be people betting on the draft. Number 66 on your list, Petey Halpin. To me, this is going to be the one that stings Texas the most, because I think they could really, really use an impact bat. Obviously, I mean, having a Jared Kelly in the rotation would be incredible for them, but that was just never a realistic option. Whereas Halpin, another one of those guys, kind of like Witt, that's kind of moved up, I think. You know, a center fielder out of California. What are you kind of hearing on him? I think that he's a guy, again, when he committed, I think Texas felt good about getting that guy on campus as a true impact guy right away, kind of in the top end of their lineup. But now it seems like he's probably more likely to go pro.
Ooh, I'm going to disagree with you there. He's got a big number.
Oh, really?
School. Yeah. I've heard some different accounts. If I had to sort of average them together, it would be that his number is, call it late first round. And I think almost every team has him top to middle of the second round. So I don't think there's a very big overlap in terms of teams that think he is worth that number and then trying to figure out, you know, when do you get to the pick where a team has enough money to meet his price and he's the top guy on their board. Like, there's not a lot of overlap there. I would call this one, let's say 20% chance he signs.
Wow.
I'm not like 100% certain on this signability information, but the indication from everyone I have asked is, oh, I think he's going to go to school.
Wow, interesting. You just made a lot of fans, including probably some people in Texas that might listen to this as well. I had the recruiting coordinator on last week, and yeah, he'd probably be doing cartwheels if they could get that guy on campus. Wow, okay. Well, that could be music to Texas fans' ears. They could really, really use that kind of bat in the lineup. I would say of the Texas signees, I know there's a couple other guys that have kind of been mentioned, Lucas Gordon a little bit, another prep pitcher out of California, lefty. Mitchell Daly.
Nope, he's going to school. You can count on that one.
Yeah, Mitchell Daly from California. I heard he's got a little, tiny bit of buzz, but I think that's got to be a guy that goes to campus as well.
I mean, I would think so.
Five rounds. I mean, there's only so many picks this year for guys to go. The only current Texas player I think that's going to be selected is going to be Bryce Elder. Have you heard anything about him? To me, he's a really fascinating guy. He's gotten so much better over the course of college, but he's also a sinker guy, which I know you're kind of seeing that pitch almost become extinct to an extent in Major League Baseball. I mean, obviously you got your guys like Mike Soroka and Brady Singer out of Florida recently who kind of have that as their calling card, but you don't really see as many sinkers. I guess that's probably because of the data telling these teams, hey, you know, in terms of the batted ball and things like that and missing bats, it's just not as valuable of a pitch. But what have you heard about Elder? Where do you think he potentially goes in the draft?
So he was a guy that has definitely taken a step forward. He now looks like he's got a shot to be a starter, which I don't think was like a slam dunk earlier in his career. But in talking to some analyst types, they were telling me, as you can probably surmise from him being a sinker slider type, that the TrackMan data was just okay. And so in a universe of everybody wanting to take college pitchers and there being every shape and size of college pitcher, he is not the shape and size that people want to bet on when there are a lot of alike players, but they'll take him when he's the best guy. And the point where he is clearly the best guy is later in the draft. So I would expect him to go fourth or fifth round. I would say he will get picked, but I would not say it is a 100% or even a 95% or whatever we want to say the, you know, very likely odds are there's some shot he doesn't get picked.
And I think that covers all the Texas ones. Yeah, it's hard to cover more Texas guys when you don't have more than five rounds.
I would also say I had heard some recent stuff about Lucas Gordon, that his spin rates and his spin axis and all that stuff has been being optimized recently. So I think he might have a good chance to be a impact freshman in the sort of like upper 80s, low 90s pitchability lefty with good off-speed stuff. So he's sort of got all the markers. So I would keep an eye on that one.
He's another one that I think somebody tweeted out a video of him throwing a bullpen, and it was like 99% spin efficiency at like 91 yep. miles an hour. And it's like, well, if you've got a pitchability guy that has that kind of spin efficiency, that's got to be a chance to be an impact guy right away. But, yeah, I think in a normal draft, you'd probably hear some names like Zach Zubia and Cam Fields and Cole Quintanilla. Maybe a Coy Cobb who's a draft-eligible sophomore. Maybe some of those guys would potentially go probably beyond the 10th round, or maybe Fields and Quintanilla might sneak in before the 10th round. But, yeah, it seems like Elder is going to be the only one from the Texas roster that probably hears his name called. And, you know, hopefully he gets selected. I think he's got some real upside as a starting pitcher. But before we wrap it up here, just a couple rapid-fire ones. Who's the guy that you've kind of planted your flag in the sand for that you are – you know, higher than the industry in terms of your ranking? You're just convinced that you are right about this guy. The consensus is wrong, and he's going to be an impact big leaguer.
So the guy that was true about a month ago was Tyler Soderstrom, where I felt like the sort of competing publications had him around 20, and I had him like 9 or 10, and it seemed like the consensus is he would go somewhere around 20, and I just thought he was better than that. And now the consensus is he's going to go around 12 or 13. And I've seen him like, you know, scoot up a little bit on some of the other rankings. So it seems like I'm not going to say I like, you know, drove the bus on that one, but it seems like I was a little ahead of the consensus, or maybe I was just sort of doing some mock drafty stuff a little before everybody else was. I just heard the teams up there liked him that much. So he was the answer I had been using. I think the other one, which maybe it's not like I'm higher on him than everyone else, although I probably am. But the guy I'm most intrigued by because of his skill set is Mason Wynn, a high school shortstop and right-handed pitcher out of Texas. He's committed to Arkansas, so nice job, Longhorns. Come on, get in.
I think he was originally a Stanford commit and then changed it to Arkansas. He's actually
that sounds right. I believe that's
true. Pingwood, where I kind of grew up. I grew up in the Spring Klein area, but I've actually seen him a couple of times. He's a real two-way talent.
Yeah, and the funny thing is there's a lot of two-way talents where it just sort of becomes, you know, something you footnote in their history. Like Hunter Green was like probably a second or third rounder as a shortstop, but it's like, yeah, your top five guy is a pitcher, so you're not going to do that. Mason Wynn is being looked at as an actual two-way player by multiple teams. He'll go somewhere from 25 to 40. He is a 70 runner with a 70 arm, chance to be average to above both hit, power, and field at shortstop. So on his own, could kind of go in that range just because he's a shortstop. On the mound, he is almost completely optimized for the TrackMan age with a mid-90s fastball up to 98, a super high spin. I think it's top 10 in the entire draft class, high school, college, and junior college. Spin rate on his curveball that also visually checks out to be a 65 or a 70. And the issue is he's like 5'10", 180, and there's a little bit of effort there. There's also been some maturity issues, we'll say, in the past, but the teams that have really done the homework feel like that is behind him and are not worried about it. And it sounds like the teams that like him the most are Tampa Bay and San Diego, among a couple others. And both of them have a history of having two-way players, and it sounds like the plan would generally be to send him out as a shortstop and have him pitch a couple times, maybe once or twice a week, maybe in mop-up time, throw an inning here or there, maybe DH that day, and kind of work him in and let him develop both ways and just sort of see what pops. Because I think even if you were to, you know, get some people that were involved in Tampa when they took Brendan McKay, he was, what, fourth overall? And they thought when they drafted him, he was more of a hitter than a pitcher. And I can say that, like, they were not the only team that thought that. And then basically 1 year later, they were like, we were wrong. He's a better pitcher than hitter. And now he's basically a primary pitcher that's like a pinch hitter, I guess, in the big leagues is probably what he's going to turn into. And he looked like he was a top five pick as a hitter and now is basically just going to be in the big leagues and not really hitting very much. So these things are not always obvious. And he would have been a perfect case where the tools are so bonkers and Arkansas is one of the better programs, I'd say, alongside Vanderbilt and a couple others at developing players like this, that if you put him in college, he probably would go in the top 10 overall after 3 years, one of the two ways. I guess maybe both, but probably more one than the other. And in this case, it looks like it's going to get sort of decided on the backfields. That even the reduction of roster spots in short season baseball will not stop a talent like this from having a spot to develop.
Yeah, I think guys like him, sometimes you think that, you know, maybe they didn't end up going to college just because it's like they get an opportunity to play both. And now you've got these organizations that are smartly, you know, saying, hey, we can potentially develop you at both and give you that opportunity, where I think that's a little different than maybe it would have been in the past, where it's like, nope, this is what we think you are. This is what you're going to do. You're going to specialize this. You're not going to do anything else. What do you think will be, you know, besides the obvious and the picks and the things like that, would there be a surprise in the draft, or what do you think that there'll be the thing that people are still kind of talking about after the draft that maybe would, I don't know, surprise people or kind of catch them off guard, that's maybe a little bit different than drafts in the past?
The biggest story from this draft will be 2 and 3 years from now when people realize how many high school players should have been drafted and signed that were not. It is going to be staggering. I don't know what the over-under should be and like how many high school players will get drafted. Again, if I'm going to do my my mock sports book here.
Set the line.
Whatever you think it should be. I mean, like I said, there's a bunch of teams that are listing 20 and 30 players, and they are, you know, there's only 15 players they might actually have a shot at taking that are high school players. And obviously, you know, once you get a couple rounds in, there might only be a few of them left. I think there's going to be a number of teams that take zero high school players. And I think the overall number of high school players signed will be very low. And this is a pretty good, it's like an above average high school class. So there are, I mean, especially from talking to agents and going through their roster, and they're like, yeah, I got this guy. He's from the upper Midwest. He was okay this summer. His number's 1.5 million. We're pretty confident that he would have gotten that if he got a full spring. He's like bigger and stronger, but nobody saw him play this spring. And there's like 20 guys like that. That I'm just like, oh, in a normal draft with a normal spring and a normal amount of rounds, a normal amount of money, half of those 20 guys would sign, if not more. And now basically none of them will. And so getting that many more players into college baseball with that kind of real upside, the big tools that don't normally get on campus, unless it's a very well-off family of Vanderbilt, you know, it's one of those situations where it makes sense. Those kids are going to school, and college baseball, in addition to all the juniors and seniors coming back, is going to be a lot better.
Yeah, I think college baseball is about to receive an influx in talent that it hasn't really seen before in terms of all these juniors that are going to be coming about. It creates a very unique set of headaches for roster management and juggling those scholarships and everything like that. But I'm sure a lot of these coaches will gladly try to figure out a way, considering the amount of talent that might be coming into the sport, which is good. I think it's close to maybe potentially getting a little bit more media coverage, getting more television revenue and those sorts of things, and can maybe become a revenue sport eventually, because as you probably know, a lot of these programs aren't really making that much money right now. Well, Kylie, thank you so much, man. I know you're a busy guy. You're prepping for the draft, which is coming up on ESPN both Wednesday and Thursday. Tune in to watch Kylie and the rest of the ESPN team. I'm fired up about it. Just this much of draft coverage is exciting, and I know a lot of people will be tuning in. And I think that you made a lot of Texas friends if Petey Halpin does indeed show up, because I think that's a guy that show up and hit in the top of the lineup from the jump. But I know you're a busy man. I've bugged you long enough. Thank you so much for the time. You can follow Kylie on Twitter at KileyMCD. Go on there, follow him, follow all of his great work at ESPN. I always refer people, if they don't really know the scouting scale, just Google Kylie McDaniel Fangraphs 2080 scale. It is like the book on just explaining the scouting scale and all those sorts of things. I refer it often to people that are trying to learn more about scouting. And go out or go on Amazon and buy Kylie's book as well. I'm really excited to read it because I've been waiting for somebody to write a book like this. So thanks again so much, man. Good luck on the draft. And any last parting words?
Yeah, two quick things. In the pitch from the publisher for the book, they mentioned those articles and said, could you just like expand these to be like 300 pages? And I was like, you know what? How about 380? I'm going to do you one better. And the other part is, if you're not sick of me after an hour of this, boy, do I have 10 more hours for you of baseball coverage on ESPN.
Oh, there we go. That's what we call a teaser. See, you've come to the dark side of journalism and you're already perfected the craft of a good tease.
We're trying to get those clicks. Let's do a clickbait headline.
Get those clicks in, get those views in. I know I will do my best to promote you on orangebloods.com and get all those subscribers tuned in as well. So for Kylie, I'm Dustin McComas from orangebloods.com. Thank you for listening to another edition of the Extra Bases podcast. Until I talk to y'all next time, take care.